Hello, Robert Stark here. I'm joined here with Matt Forney. Matt, great having you back on.
Yeah, thanks for having me back on, Robert.
So you were recently attended the MPI conference, Richard Spencer's National Policy Review in Washington, D.C. How did that go?
The conference was very... this is not my first time going to a conference. I went to AMRIN back in April, but the conference went along great, mainly because the speakers were fantastic. I met a lot of great people, and despite their attempts to do so, the Antifas, the anti-fascists, did not manage to shut down the conference. It sounds a bit generic, but I recommend if you're on the fence about going to one of these identitarian conferences, I'd say go. They're great fun. And they're great fun. You learn a lot, and you network with a lot of people who are on the same wavelength as you ideologically.
I know Richard gave a discount to anyone under 30, but I turned 30 on October 30th, so I think maybe he did that just to, like, up my price to prevent me from going. Who knows?
I don't think so. I mean, you know, I met Spencer. I got to talk to Spencer a couple times. He's a real sweetheart, you know.
So what are some of the speakers that stood out to you, the biggest impression?
Now, I can't really judge Kevin McDonald's speech because that was the only one I missed. I got into the conference late. But what stuck out to me was I'm probably mispronouncing his name, Guillaume Fay, the author of...
Is it Guillaume Fay?
Yes. His speech was by far the most standout because it was more or less, he was explaining why we being the identitarians, the alternative right, are going to win. And it was... his delivery was fantastic. Like, he was very engaging, and his arguments, I couldn't argue with that. Number two, I'd say Jack Donovan's speech was excellent as well. He gave a speech basically outlining sort of, you know, how we should act now that we've given up on the idea of America and we're looking forward to building a new nation, new people, a new identity, how we should conduct ourselves. And finally, I really enjoyed Richard Spencer's speech himself. He spoke again about his... about his travails at the getting arrested by the Hungarian government and whatnot. Those are the standout performances. All of these speakers were great, but those are the standout speeches, in my opinion.
Was there overall like a different theme than AMRIN? I've been to conferences, but I've never been to any of the major ones like AMRIN and MPI.
The main difference between AMRIN and MPI is that AMRIN is, by definition, a big tent conference that doesn't really have a specific sort of beyond promoting white nationalism, doesn't really have a specific focus, whereas MPI is smaller and more tightly focused on a specific, and all the speeches revolved around a certain idea. The name of the MPI speech was Become Who We Are. Basically, it's about inspiring, you know, and Richard Spencer talked about this in his speech, you know, it's like, we're talking about trying to preserve white people and white culture, but, like, we're not fighting to preserve, like, the culture of consumerism, mindless consumption, sexual degeneracy, all that. We're trying to preserve ourselves, but at the same time, we're trying to become better than who we are. We're trying to be the best people we can be. That was really, that's what separates AMRIN from MPI.
Did you have any, like, personal run-ins with Antifa? I mean, you were basically saying your overall impression was in that they were pretty pathetic.
Not personally. What happened, on the morning of the conference when I got there, there was, like, a crowd of, like, five people who were, like, cheering me. Like, me and my friend got out of the cab, and they were like, hey, you're here for the National Policy Institute? And it was like, yeah, and they're like, fuck you, fucking Nazis, neo-Nazi scum, racist, blah, blah, blah. Now, I had to exit the conference and go back to meet a friend of mine a couple blocks away. When I tried to get back in the building, there was one Antifa who physically tried to block me from entering. Like, I'd go up to the doors, and he'd, like, step in front of the doors. Then I try to go for the door next to him, he'd step in front of that. And he's clearly acting in a way that he's trying to provoke me into punching him in the face. Now, one of the security guards inside let me in, and my friend, and so it didn't get violent. But what happened later that night was there were Antifas there were Antifas posted up at every entrance to the National Press building, and they were actively trying to stalk and attack MPI conference members who left. There were one guy who got the – he basically got the shit kicked out of him. because four of them ganged up on him. There was another guy I knew who was stalked and had to lose the Antifa by sneaking down back alleys and through the back of a restaurant. So to protect us from we were worried that they might try to, like, attack the older people at the conference or, like, stalk people if they came home on the Washington Metro. So at the end, Richard Spencer had us all leave the conference at the same time to sort of ward them off, safety in numbers. And it was more or less peaceful getting out because, you know, they were obviously intimidated by numbers. But one Antifa actually attacked Sam Dixon, one of the speakers, who also happens to be, I believe he's in his 70s. So there was definite danger, but it was not as dangerous as it could have been. But there was definite danger, though.
Well, one of their main tactics, I mean, you mentioned, is, I mean, they do actual attacks, but their main thing is to try to provoke an attack and make themselves out to be victims.
Yeah, in the morning, the ones who were there in the morning were trying to provoke attacks. They weren't being violent. They were just acting in such a fashion that they were trying to piss us off. The ones who came by later that night were actually trying to attack people, and they were deliberately they don't fight fair. What they were doing was that they were trying to, as I mentioned, they would gang up on people or attack, try to go after, like, the older people at the conference or, like, sucker punch people. They don't fight fair.
What is your overall impression on the city of Washington, D.C.? I mean, you obviously you said the atmosphere at Ameren, not the conference, but the surrounding area, you much preferred it. You're not a big fan of D.C.?
Well, D.C., as a friend of mine put it, D.C. would be great if it got rid of the people. The buildings there are nice, the physically nice city, just the people there are just so unlikable, snobby, and just overall just full of themselves that the city is unbearable.
You're saying it's more the upper-class people who are snobby or more the people who are ghetto or both?
I didn't really do much interaction with the ghetto people, but, like, the people who work for the government there, the middle-class, upper-class, are very snobby and full of themselves.
Has that been your experience more so than other cities?
Yeah, I mean, D.C. is kind of a special case because I don't know about the majority, but a large proportion of the population that lives there is not from there. They're coming there for government work, obviously. So I think that's part of it. I got a similar sort of attitude from living in Portland, Oregon. Something like half of the city of Portland are transplants from other states. And it seems to be sort of a running theme where if transplants make up a large percentage of a city's population, they're going to be very snotty, cliquish, and just hostile to newcomers. Ironically, considering that they are newcomers themselves. The main difference, though, is that Portland people are, well, most of them are unemployed or underemployed. Where the people in D.C., you know, obviously they have jobs. So to a certain extent, they do have something to be just a little snobby about, I guess.
I've definitely found that true being from L.A. I personally have family who's lived in L.A. since the 1920s. But I've actually found, like, the people who have the most obnoxious sort of L.A. stereotype are almost always transplants. Like, the kind of people who want to be, like, reality stars, most of them are transplants, either from the Midwest, East Coast, or in some case, foreign countries.
Yeah, you get the same thing in New York City, too. Like, the stereotype of New Yorkers being rude and obnoxious, that actually comes from people who moved to New York City. The people from New York who actually grew up there tend to be a lot more chill. Because the people who are transplants feel they have something to prove. They feel excluded from the city's social structure, so they overcompensate by being boorish assholes.
Have you personally lived in New York City, or just visited there a lot when you grew up in upstate New York?
Yeah, pretty much. That's what we did every time we could, you know. So I'm pretty familiar with the city's culture, you know. I wrote about this about a year ago for an article for Tacky Mag. You know, basically, the biggest snobs in New York City now are these trust fund hipsters coming in from, like, Wisconsin and Minnesota on a mommy and daddy's credit line, who are voting in extreme leftism, unaware that it was the and complaining about the racism and the brutality of Giuliani and Bloomberg's NYPD, not knowing that it was the policies of Giuliani and Bloomberg that actually made it safe, the city safe enough for them to visit, you know, prior to the crackdown on crime that happened in the 90s, New York City was incredibly violent and not a pleasant place to be at all. I mean, It wasn't too long ago that, like, Times Square was full of, like, you know, seedy porno theaters and, like, junkies shooting up in the streets. You know, it was the policies that these hipsters agitate against that made it possible for said hipsters to even live in the city to begin with.
So you were talking about the people on trust funds from the Midwest who moved into New York for transplants.
Yeah, basically they're the ones who are responsible for moving they vote in ever more extreme forms of leftism, like in the form of Bill de Blasio, the current mayor, is a major example, and they complain about the racism of the supposed racism and brutality of the New York City Police Department. Yet it was those strong arm tactics by the NYPD to actually, under Giuliani and Bloomberg, that actually made the city safe enough for them to move to, you know. Because of the crackdown on crime that New York City's crime rate dropped, and you know, like, for example, back in as recently as the 80s, Times Square, a major tourist attraction in downtown Manhattan, was full of seedy porno theaters and junkies shooting up in the streets. So many of the more extreme leftism problems in general in places like New York or D.C. are caused by people who are not from there trying to overcompensate to fit in.
I know we talked about this on a previous show, but one point you can make is that if you look at the city today, it's become much safer, but there's not as much cultural innovation. I know that whole era in the 80s is really become sort of iconic in film. Like, there was a recent film out called American Hustle.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of captures that pretty good.
Yeah, and the city has become so sterile, and so hipsters are so uncreative. Here's an example. One thing I read about a month ago. You have these hipsters in New York City going on juice crawls now, not bar crawls, juice crawls, where they'll go from like juice bar to juice bar, drinking cold pressed juice and thinking they're being hip and cool and ironic. You know, that's their idea of creativity. We're a long way from the New York City of, you know, Lou Reed and David Byrne.
Are you old enough to remember some of that era? I know you basically grew up in the 90s.
Not really. I grew up in the, you know, 88, but when I was growing up, most of the music I listened to was, like, I was a big fan of Sonic Youth. I was a big fan of Talking Heads, et cetera, you know. So most of the culture I sort of consumed was from the late 70s and 80s. So I sort of have an affinity with that, even though I didn't grow up in the era. The one thing I would recommend, it's a documentary called Kill Your Idols, and it basically documents the no wave scene from the late 70s or early 80s in New York City, and features interviews with, like, some of the notable figures, like I think Thurston Moore's in it, the lead singer of Sonic Youth. Lydia Lunch was also interviewed in it. It's a documentary that explores the culture of the city as it existed in the late 70s or early 80s.
And you're currently in Chicago. I know as far as cities go, New York is like the number one tourist attraction. I know a lot of people tend to kind of avoid Chicago as a tourist attraction. I guess maybe I'm wrong, but that's sort of my perception.
Well, there are a lot of tourists in Chicago, don't get me wrong. Most of the aversion to Chicago comes from, like, other Americans, like for example, East Coasters who seem to think everywhere west of Cleveland is some kind of barbaric wasteland. You know, and Chicago is violent, don't get me wrong. The Chirac name is well-deserved. But all the violence is concentrated in the South Side and in high-crime areas. Like, I live in an area – I live in Rogers Park, which is on the far northern end of the city. This area is, like, edgy. About a couple months ago, I had the joy of witnessing a couple of youths of a certain ethnic extraction beating a old white man to death in the alley after a failed B&E. But overall, the area is pretty safe. You know, it's like it's not ideal, but it's safe and affordable. The main reason I like Chicago is because as far as large cities go, it's very the culture is very unpretentious. It's a very working class city. People here are a lot politer than they are in New York, I haven't been to LA long enough to judge, but a lot better than New York and D.C. There's a more cohesive culture, social culture here, and it also hasn't been gentrified out ridiculously like New York City has. So it's affordable to live in. Basically, it's in many ways, Chicago retains its own unique character compared to it hasn't really been affected by the hipster gentrification wave. You have the hipsters here, but it's not as strong as it is in New York City or D.C.
So what part of Chicago do you live in specifically? Can you talk about that area?
Like I said, I live in Rogers Park, which is on the far northern end of the city, actually bordering a couple of the suburbs, Skokie and Evanston. Evanston is where Northwestern University is located. I don't want to get too specific, but like Rogers Park is about, I'd say, 50% Mexican and 50% white hippies. And like I said, it could be better, you know. Having to witness a white guy, an old man getting beaten to death in the alley was not pleasant in the slightest. And one of my friends who visited here back over the summer, he had a bike with him that he tied to a post where he could tie it to while he wasn't using it. Some thugs actually came along and ripped the spikes out of the ground and stole the bike that way. But in terms of violence here, in terms of crime, it's relatively sedate by Chicago standards. There are better neighborhoods to live in, but this neighborhood has Rogers Park has the advantage of being both relatively safe and affordable.
As far as places that you've lived throughout your life, do you generally prefer like urban living to suburban or rural living?
I lean towards urban living at the moment because really, I spent most of my life in like rural or suburban living. I grew up in, Syracuse, I guess, technically counted as urban living, but the city is very small, and I lived in a portion of the city that was basically just a suburb that had an annex to the city. So the advantages of urban living for me is that I don't have to own a car anymore. In my specific case, I live about a couple blocks away from the L, which is, you know, the Chicago subway train system. So that's an advantage for me. A lot of my friends live here. That was my primary motivator for coming here. So for me, urban living is what I prefer. I can see why people would gravitate towards suburban or rural living. Like, if you have a family, you know, I would not raise them in Chicago. It's too expensive, and the areas that are not too expensive are not safe for children to be in. But for what I want right now, you know, Chicago is pretty perfect.
So Portland is basically the only West Coast city you've had significant experience with.
Pretty much. Portland has many characteristics of a large city. Like for example, the MAX. I didn't own a car when I lived there. It's very walkable. My main problem with Portland isn't so much the. I like the city itself. But the people there, the social culture is something I just couldn't jive with, you know. There are some cool people there, but overall I just didn't really care for the whole sort of the weird combination of, like, slacker culture and just snobbishness, you know.
So the difference, so New York is, like, rich hipsters. Portland is poor hipsters, so they're not snobbish in, like, an economic sense, but more in that they feel.
Yeah.
Does Portlandia capture it pretty well?
Yeah, Portlandia is pretty accurate, and it's so accurate that I can't even watch the show anymore. I don't think it's funny. Like, people who haven't been to Portland think it's funny. I don't think it's funny because I live there, you know. That is how people actually act in Portland, you know. To me, it's not like a comedy show anymore. It's a documentary.
I know there's generally been kind of a perception on the right that traditionalist conservatives, both mainstream conservatives and the alternative right, generally dislike cities. Mainstream, I think traditionalists generally see like the small town as ideal, while mainstream conservatives fetishize the suburbs. On the other hand, people on the left tend to like cities, but at the same time, they also played a role in the destruction of cities and driving out the middle class through a lot of their policies.
Yeah, pretty much. I pretty much agree with the conservative notion that like small towns are a better place for family values. At the moment, I really don't have any. I don't have any plans. Period. To get married and have a kid. So you know, I gravitate towards urban living. But I would dispute though that the suburbs are better than the best. My opinion on suburbs is this: like, they're an unfortunate social development, but they develop in part because the left is largely because the left destroyed the cities. It sounds a bit extreme, but in many ways you can look at the what happened in cities like Detroit or Baltimore, where middle class whites were driven out by disorganized black violence, which was either not sufficiently clamped down on by the police, or even, if you want to go to one extreme, actually sort of tolerated. Like, we have, for example, recently during the Baltimore riots earlier this year, we had the mayor talking about how the protesters need to be given space to destroy. The suburbs, they shouldn't exist, but they need to exist. Like, in an ideal world, you would not have these sort of artificial prefab cities that have no real culture or rootedness, but at the same time, it's either that or try to raise your kids in a extremely violent ghetto shithole. If those are your two choices, then yeah, the suburbs are your best option by a long shot.
Yeah, I mean, it basically depends what your goal is. If you want to raise a family, then it's a better ideal. But if you want like excitement, obviously, it could be pretty boring too. I mean, small towns, I don't know. I mean, I understand why people want to live in small towns, but at the same time, I would probably get bored because I grew up in a big city.
Well, I've lived in small towns before. It's generally obviously more tolerable when you have like roots down there. Like, for example, most of my family is my dad's family is from like a small town in upstate New York. There's a certain sort of joy knowing that you have a extended relatives there, and all the neighbors know each other, and there's a certain level of social trust. But at the same time, if you're not planning to put down roots yourself, there's really not much point in staying in these places, seeing that as they don't have much in the way of economic opportunity. That's the primary reason why I would not recommend living in a small town if you're the jobs simply aren't there.
Do you see population density as inherently bad by itself, and do you think that it could be possible you have a strong, thriving middle class within a densely populated environment?
Well, to a certain extent, we've always had large cities, and we're always going to have large cities because that's how social stratification works. But at the same time, it's to a certain extent unnatural to have all these people crushed together in one, large conglomeration. This is the further we get away from nature, the greater social dysfunction it seems to stir. The reason why we're seeing so much, shall we say, mental illness, all these sort of aberrant lifestyles, if you want to put it that way, all these sorts of it's because of a scale. There are too many people. There are too many people in this world. We're crowded into increasingly smaller spaces. This is completely against how human beings were supposed to live and were supposed to evolve. And as a result, in many cases, we're losing our minds in many ways. So to a certain extent, getting back to nature and getting back to how we are supposed to live, and I guess to a certain extent, fitting the like I'm calling for genocide. I'm not reducing the human population would benefit all of us in the long run.
The thing with suburbia is that it covers up vast areas. I think there's just something about it that can be very kind of a fake and soulless. I think the thing about it is that both like cities and being in nature can both be like places of exploration. Like the suburbs serve more of a practical purpose, but that kind of living can be really empty.
Yeah, basically I didn't grow up in a suburb, I grew up in a very suburb-like part of my city. There's really not a whole lot of cultural.
Which city was that?
Syracuse, New York.
Okay.
Yeah. You basically, it's kind of a stereotype, but to a certain extent, the leftist depiction of the suburbs in like the movies and whatnot has a certain ring of truth in it. These communities don't have any sort of there's nothing uniting them. It's not like a small town. Neighbors don't know each other. There's no unique sort of there are no unique sort of neighborhoods like restaurant. Everything's a chain. For example, you could say some place like say Oak Park, Illinois, which is an extremely wealthy Chicago suburb. The so-called historic downtown area, the Hemingway District, so-called because Ernest Hemingway was from Oak Park. It's full of nothing but chain restaurants, and it has this very prefab, fake, artificial. You can tell that the place has no culture whatsoever, and just trying to import as many high-class brands as possible to look to fake themselves cool and superior.
Would you say that Portland is more free of being overrun by chains than other cities?
I'd say that's one of the things that Portland has going for it. It does have a unique character, and it does try to preserve said unique character. I mean, I could do without the snobbishness, but I do admire the way the city has its own culture of its own entrepreneurial spirit. What with the microbrew situation, the local music culture, sort of quirky restaurants like Voodoo Donuts. You know, on that mark, they're doing a pretty good job in my estimation.
So you visited Las Vegas pretty recently, too.
I was there about a year and a half ago. But, yeah, Vegas is a very fake, very sort of prefab place with a lot of, you know. But at the same time, it's that way by design. People don't go to Vegas to soak in the local culture. They go there to get drunk, gamble, and party, you know.
It's a theme park.
Yeah, basically, but it doesn't pretend to be anything other than what it is. You know, like my friend David Cerrini put it this way. You know, at least Vegas is an honest whore.
I mean, it's the kind of place. It's fun to visit, but it's not the kind of place you'd want to live long term.
Yeah, actually, Vegas is actually pretty cheap, but you wouldn't want. I wouldn't want to live there long term because unless I had a lucrative job there, because the city just doesn't have its own. It exists to cater to out-of-towners and you know, people on vacation. You know, there's nothing there. If you actually live there, there's not much there for you.
So you're actually, interested in anti-natalism?
Well, I'm far from an expert on this. You'd have to talk to someone like Anne Sterzinger or Jim Crawford about it, but... I'm interested in anti-natalism from a sort of, detached. I guess I am a de facto anti-natalist. I'm not going to have any kids, but I'm interested in it from a detached or a philosophical viewpoint. Mostly because most people who approach the default reaction to anti-natalism, the idea that people should not have kids, and that the human race just sort of voluntarily, you know, extinguish itself through just not breeding. You know, the response is, well, why don't you just kill yourself, huh? Why don't you just kill yourself if life sucks so much? You know, whereas I thought, you know, when I first came across anti-natalist ideas, I thought, okay, why would people believe this? I'll actually look at the arguments and see what they're saying. To a certain extent, some anti-natalists can get, like, whiny, gothy, like, you know, black nail polish, you know, crying about the world. But at the same time, I think a lot of the arguments do make a good deal of sense. The main central issue I have of anti-natalism is attempting to take it's trying to apply reason to an aspect of reality that's irrational. Like the drive to breed and procreate is something that goes beyond human rationality. You know, it's like life. It's a cliche, but life exists basically to perpetuate itself. And I don't think rational arguments are going to convince people. They can even convince some people. I mean, I guess I was to a certain extent convinced by it. But you're not going to convince the human race as a whole with logical arguments to not breed. You know, it's an impulse.
And the people who are really into antinatalism, the thing is, it's a small segment of the population. You're not going to convince the masses. It also tends to be like the most sort of intelligent, deep-thinking individuals. So antinatalism, it's an interesting philosophical question, but the problem is it's not just about the numbers of people, it's about the quality. And I think antinatalism appeals to the most intelligent, deep-thinking individuals. So in that sense, I don't think it's such a great thing.
Yeah, I mean, Anne Sterzinger joked about this. Basically... the sorts of people who are going to gravitate to anti-natalism, like you said, are going to be more intelligent than the norm and to be a bit more educated. And if they don't have kids, what's going to happen is that the people who are having kids are going to be the stupidest people, the people who are the most thoughtless, the people who don't care about, you know, if we take anti-natalism 100% face value, the ones who don't care about inflicting more suffering. So to a certain extent, you know, it's not going to succeed, but it's something interesting to think about, you know.
That's also true with anti-natalist environmentalists. There are a lot of people who are environmentalists, and they've actually said they've choose to have only, like, one kid because they want to limit the population. But the problem, it's the same thing. Like, if people who are environmentalists choose not to have kids, then the people left over are not going to care about the environment.
Yeah, pretty much. I mean, I personally think people who claim to be child-free for environmental reasons are kind of full of shit because they claim to care about the environment, yet they're still using all the perks of modern living. They still got their computers, their cars, still living in nice air-conditioned houses, you know. If you're really that concerned about the environment, go live in a mud hut and roll dog turds to keep yourself warm at night. It's sort of like, you know, it's like environmentalism in general. It's like I'm in favor of conservation, but it's like you see most extreme environmentalists, like, you know, talking about how we need to save the earth. I mean, it's kind of redundant at this point to bring up like someone like Al Gore who advocates fighting global warming, yet he's wasting so much energy with his houses and his jets, you know.
We did talk about, like, the suburbs earlier. I mean, that was, like, a major ecological disaster. I was reading somewhere that if you took the population of New York City and spread it out in the suburbs, it would actually cover, like, all of New England.
Oh, yeah. And again, many of these environmentalists sort of ignore the deeper. Like, for example, someone like Jim Kunstler, the guy who wrote The Long Emergency, and he's always banging on about peak oil, he doesn't have a good analysis on how what he calls happy motoring has really sort of wrecked the American economy and wrecked American culture. But he ignores one very big reason why it happened, and it's because the cities themselves are not safe. The cities themselves are not safe to raise children in because of the threat of crime, the threat primarily black crime, and to a lesser extent crime from Latinos. People, you know, Americans didn't move to the suburbs en masse because they wanted to deliberately destroy the environment. They did so because it was the most it was the most cost-effective way of raising children in a safe environment.
It's interesting. I mean, I'm sure there was a period in history, like if you look at these cities like New York, Chicago, San Francisco, and these cities in the 1950s, there were periods where you had a city that was very extremely dense and urban, but it had a thriving middle class at the same time.
Yeah, and I forgot the name of the book right now, but there's and the name of the author. There's a fairly good argument to be had for the fact that this author particularly argued. I'm sorry, I wish I could remember the name of the author in the book, but in the 20s, 30s, and 40s, in major cities like New York City and other East Coast cities that had large immigrant populations. The immigrant populations were sort of being resistant to left-wing progressive values. They were forming the Irish, the Italians, the Poles, etc. So this author made an argument that suburbanization was actually a form of ethnic cleansing.
About E. Michael Jones' Slaughter of Cities.
Yes, that book. Basically, breaking up these communities and putting them in the suburbs also destroyed their power. There was another article I read over at the Unreview recently. I forgot who wrote it, but he grew up in Brooklyn's Bushwick neighborhood in the 60s. At the time he was growing up, the original immigrants when they came there were large Democratic supporters, but at the time in the 60s, ethnic white communities in New York City were starting to support the Conservative Party and the Republican Party. So what happened was that the Democrats decided to flood this area with immigrants, primarily from Bushwick was primarily flooded with immigrants from Haiti and other Caribbean countries to sort of ensure themselves a permanent voter base. And what happened was that Bushwick basically became one of the worst war-torn, violent shitholes in New York City. Bushwick is being gentrified now because by hipsters, but from the late 60s up until about 10 years ago, it was pretty much uninhabitable. And this author also contrasted the violent riots that broke out during the New York City blackout in 1977 to the blackout that occurred in, I think it was 66, where it was largely peaceful. the reason why the riots in 1977 happened was because of all the immigrants that had been coming in to stabilize the country, the city's social fabric.
And who were the riots specifically? Which groups were they specifically between?
It was just general, like, you know, it was primarily, you know, blacks and underclass people rioting to steal stuff and just cause general anarchy. They were taking advantage of the fact that the lights were out. The city was in a state blackout to just, you know, steal whatever they wanted.
I know in Chicago they've actually, what they've done is I know they shut down a lot of the major housing projects like Cabrini and Green, but what's been going on is those people have ended up in places like Wisconsin.
Oh, yeah. This is actually something that my friend talked to me about. It's like, Cabrini Green, for better or for worse, these housing projects actually help contain gang violence. Because what happened, like, in the case, specific case of Cabrini Green, each public housing building was owned by one gang. And so you had inter-gang warfare, but at the same time, in the project itself, people were all part of the same gang, so they didn't stab each other. What happened was when Cabrini Green was demolished and all these gang members were given Section 8 vouchers to move to Wisconsin or to the South Side, you've got all these gangs now that are mixed up among each other and they're naturally going to start shooting each other.
And also it sort of condenses a lot of those people in that one area. When you spread them out, you spread their problems over a larger area.
Yeah, you know, Cabrini Green was Mayor Daley actually constructed a highway to isolate Cabrini Green off from other parts of the city. But when you demolish the project and you give all the people Section 8 vouchers to live wherever they want, they take their crime with them. If I was correctly, there was an experiment, I think it was somewhere in Tennessee, where the local government decided to, they were trying to determine whether a location causes poverty or poverty causes location. So instead of lumping all the people on public housing into one area, they spread them out, hoping that putting poor people, these violent gang members in the suburbs would make them more peaceful. What happened was they brought the crime with them, and they just spread the crime to all these previously nice areas.
I'm going to ask you about the author Michel Houellebecq. Have you read his books? Have you reviewed any of his books?
I read Whatever. That's the English title. I can't really pronounce the French title. I read Whatever years ago. I haven't read any new of his newer books, though I am familiar with his new book, Submission. Though from what I understand, I haven't been able to read it yet because the English translation just came out. But I'm familiar with Houellebecq and his themes and that he writes about in his book.
So Houellebecq's Whatever, I haven't read that one. I've read his book Platforms, about this middle-aged French bureaucrat who is living a pretty boring, like, lonely life. And he's really, well, he's depressed and kind of nihilistic. And his father dies and he inherits all this money and he goes on, like, a sex tour across the world. But basically the theme with Houellebecq's writing is he's not really, I don't think he's part of any kind of political ideology. He's not really a traditionalist per se. I think he just kind of likes chronicalizing the degeneracy of modern society. But he kind of has a rejection of the whole sort of the 68ers in France and that whole movement.
Yeah. Yeah, the central thrust of Houellebecq's writing is how capitalism and free market capitalism has intruded on the domain of romantic and sexual relationships. I haven't read Platform, but Whatever basically touches on the same territory. It's about an unnamed narrator who has this, again, he has this boring bureaucratic job. He has no love life, and his hobby consists of running these weird sort of, like, short stories, political dialogues between, like, animals. And the thrust of the story is that he gets to... He teams up with this coworker of his named Raphael Tisserand, probably pronouncing that wrong as well, who is this ridiculously ugly Jewish virgin, and they team up to murder this happy couple they see that's frolicking on the beaches having sex. What ultimately happens is that Tisserand ends up chickening out, and then he gets hit by a car and killed. Basically, it's sort of analysis of these sort of people who have lost out in the sexual revolution, these sort of marginal men I guess there are marginal women as well. Again, I haven't read 12 Eckler work, so I can't judge. From 12X's perspective, you see a bunch of people getting all the spoils, and a lot of people just ending up with nothing or next to nothing.
I think he's responsible for coining that term, the sexual marketplace.
I don't know if he coined it, but basically that is something that he would have come up with. And from what you're saying, what I know about platform is basically the same sort of thing, posturing on sex tourism, et cetera. The idea is that free market capitalism, sexual relationships, romantic relationships, have started to resemble a cutthroat free market capitalist environment where if you win, you win big, but if you lose, you get nothing. You know, there's no fairness, but life isn't fair. But at the same time, you know, we have romantic relations being dictated by economics to a degree that really hasn't been experienced throughout the rest of human history.
Are there any other writers that you would make comparisons to, writers throughout history? I mean, he is considered probably one of the most innovative modern-day writers, past writers that you see an influence from.
Well, Beck, his primary influence and the primary influence of a lot of great writers of the 20th century is the early 20th century novelist Louis Ferdinand Céline. I've probably talked about this on podcasts before. Novels such as Journey to the End of the Night and Death on the Installment Plan, they revolve around his titular protagonist, Ferdinand Bartomeu. It doesn't broach on the same subject matter because the culture of 30s and 40s France was obviously different than the culture of today. But the same sort of nihilist.
Was he writing his books during the World War II, or this was before the war?
Yeah.
I know he was a supporter of the Vichy government.
He started writing before the war, but he kept writing up until he died in the early 60s. So he observed the war. His writings also touched on pre-war France, a really uncompromising and bleak look at France and the West in general. And many writers, Houellebecq acknowledges Céline as an influence. Many other writers of the 20th, like William Burroughs, the Beats were also. They were huge fans of Céline as well, and Kerouac, Burroughs were highly influenced by him. Ken Kesey was influenced by him. Kurt Vonnegut was influenced. All these writers were different, and they tackled different subject matters, and they had different writing styles, but it all stems back to this one guy.
Would you say Céline is one of the most underrated writers? He's had a major influence on famous writers, but he's not someone that most high school students are going to have reading in English class in some ways.
He's not as well known
by the masses.
Well, Céline was more or less written out of the history books because he was a supporter of the Vichy French government, and because he published several anti-Semitic pamphlets when he was in the late 30s and 40s. It had nothing to do with his actual writing talents. Because he had bad political opinions, in quotes, his fantastic books have, to a certain extent, I don't want to say forgotten, obviously, because his writing still endures, but he doesn't get the credit that he deserves.
As far as writers go, is it generally true that a lot of really innovative writers have controversial views? That's definitely the case. I mean, a writer who has politically correct views is going to be really boring. I mean, even the writers who are leftists who are truly innovative are going to make controversial statements that will offend people. Some of the writers who are held up by mainstream like literary journals, a lot of them are actually pretty, their writing is pretty bland or it's edgy in a kind of faux sense.
Yeah. We basically entered into an environment where, in order to be as marketable as possible, publishing companies are looking for writers who are as bland as possible and who sort of parrot the sort of beigeist, sort of bland, vaguely progressive viewpoints. They can't be threatening in any way, which is the reason why modern fiction writing has fallen off a cliff. When you have people like Jonathan Safran Foer, David Franzen, Jonathan Franzen, David Foster Wallace, you know, Tao Lin being promoted. You and people are shocked that no one really cares about literary fiction anymore. It's because these people are boring, and because they don't take risks, and they're not truthful in their writing.
About Welbeck, I think what he's most known for is not so much his book. You were talking about Whatever. I think that came out about 10 years ago, and at the time it wasn't that famous. He didn't become really famous on a global level until what happened is I think it's because the Charlie Hebdo magazine where the terrorist attack happened, they were the ones publishing his book, Submission.
He was actually famous about 10 years ago when he was actually prosecuted by a French court for hate speech because he called Islam the stupidest of all religions. But he gained some new fame with the Charlie Hebdo attacks because, number one, he was being interviewed in that issue of Charlie Hebdo, but also because the book is about how an Islamist gets elected president of France in 2020. So it was obviously very topical, and considering what's happening in France as we talk about this now, with these attacks happening across Paris, it really seems kind of prescient with all these Islamic terrorist attacks that are going on in Paris right now.
Yeah, I mean, it's extremely topical. This is happening as we speak. There's always been this kind of premise that the establishment will still be in power. He actually, in his book, which is a fictional book, but I think he does genuinely believe this will likely happen, he believes that Islamists could actually take over the government from the establishment.
Yeah, the premise
of... see that as a possible premise, or do you think it will be more that the establishment will stay in power and you'll have this large foreign underclass as kind of its pawn? His premise is that they'll actually take down the establishment.
I think the establishment is going to try... The establishment is obviously trying to maintain power on their own without any... keeping the underclass at bay. But what's going to happen is eventually, as the Islamic underclass grows, they're going to eventually take control. It's inevitable. We're seeing this to a certain extent right now with the so-called refugee crisis, with leaders in Germany, France, elsewhere, siding with these refugees over their own people. What eventually happens is that you cannot have one elite class of a certain ethnic extraction ruling over people of a different ethnic extraction indefinitely. Eventually, the two groups will come to blows, and the group that has the greater numbers is always the one that wins. You can take, for example, what happened in Malaysia in the 50s, the guerrilla war between the native ethnic Malays and the Malaysian Chinese. The Malaysian Chinese were effectively the elite of a British Malaya because they were more economically successful than the native Malays. What eventually happened is that the Malays the two groups came to blows. And the Chinese ended up losing because they were relatively small in number.
I think that's definitely been the case in a lot of conflicts in history. Whenever you have one minority that's more successful and they're a minority, it's pretty much inevitable that they're going to fall. I mean, I guess in Latin America, you have a lot of the white elites in those countries are still in power, but there's always that fear of like a revolution.
Basically. Well, here's another historical example from... the Norman invasion of Ireland. The reason the Normans invaded Ireland was because, I forget the name of the kings who were involved, but one of the Irish kings was feuding with another Irish king, so he brought the Normans, his allies, the Normans from overseas to help the Irish king that he was feuding with. But what ended up happening was that the Normans, who at the time ruled England, the English ended up ruling Ireland, or parts of it, for most of 800, 900 years. So, siding with foreigners against your own people inevitably results in the said foreigners taking over. It's happened that way so many times throughout history that there's no way that it could not possibly happen in this situation in modern Europe and America now, unless there's a drastic course correction.
Maybe, like, one theory I've heard put out on Trump is that Donald Trump is, like, he's basically, like, traveled over the world, and he's seen how elites live in like places like South America, where they have to constantly have bodyguards and keep themselves separate. They constantly have that fear, like one of their family members could be kidnapped, and like he doesn't want to live in that kind of country. even though he's part of one of the wealthiest people himself.
Yeah, I'm not going to get too excited over Donald Trump. I do think he's by far the best candidate for the presidency, but that is a good point. You could have these. Everyone says that America is moving toward a situation where, like Brazil, where we'll have like one, a very white elite ruling over a largely brown mixed race populace. What happens is Brazil is so violent that the elite have to fly around in helicopters and to protect themselves from the incredible amounts of gang violence that are going on. You know, that is not ideal for any country to live up to. I mean, that's why everyone jokes that, you know, Brazil is the country of the future and it always will be.
And with the situation in Europe, I mean, how do you see things turning out? Do you think nationalists will come to power? Or do you see there being a civil war? Are you very pessimistic?
Well, you could say that there's a civil war going on in France right at this moment with all these Islamic attacks going on, but I really can't say what I personally hope. There could have been a peaceful solution to this problem maybe 10 or possibly even 5 years ago, but at the moment there's really no way out of this but violence. What I see happening is either there's going to be a swing towards nationalism, which we've seen with the refugee crisis. You know, we've seen nationalist groups gaining power in Germany, France, I guess to a lesser extent in Britain. The Eastern European countries like Hungary and Poland are resisting the refugee invasion. Hungary's Prime Minister Viktor Orban got chewed out by the international media for putting up a border wall to keep migrants from coming in and running the country over. Either it's going to be nationalists who take back these countries and reestablish that the France is for the French, Germany is for the Germans, etc., or we're going to see an Islamic takeover. There's really no middle ground at this point. Again, it would have been possible to peacefully sort of avert this 10 years ago, 20 years ago, 30 years ago, but the ruling elite in these countries have been so intent on importing foreigners who are hostile to the native country's values that this is pretty much inevitable at this point.
One thing that is ironic about this terrorist attack, if you compare it to 9/11, I mean, this really is like the worst terrorist attack in the West since 9/11. And maybe the one in Mumbai may have been worse, but this is the worst one since 9/11. But how the reaction is, I mean, this is directly tied in with the whole immigration issue. The thing with 9/11 is 9/11 actually did the opposite. There was a stronger sort of populist movement in the 90s. You had people like Perot and Buchanan who were talking about the same issues Donald Trump is happening now, and then Bush came in and 9/11 happened, and this whole sort of war and terror and adventures in the Middle East became a big distraction. And there is actually less, because I think the key difference between Europe is Muslims are the main source of immigration in Europe. 9/11 ended up having the opposite effect.
Yeah, the central difference between 9/11 and what's going on in France right now, the 9/11 hijackers were all foreigners here on visas. And while the attacks obviously killed a lot of people, there was not a wave of terrorist attacks happening immediately after. Once the 9/11 terror attacks happened, that was more or less it. What's going on in France is really more like an armed insurrection. And other writers have noted the difference. Like the Islamic terror attacks, like the Charlie Hebdo attacks or the attacks that happened in London, attacks in European countries come from Muslims who were actually born there and grew up there, whereas the Muslim attacks in the U.S., the ones that were successful anyway, come from foreigners. So we're going to see an upswell of nationalism. That's the only viable solution. Like, you know, France, in response to this attack, is not going to go on some international, you know, let's invade Iraq some horseshit like that. The solution here is pretty obvious. It's not pleasant. It's going to suck for everyone involved, but it's pretty obvious.
Do you think that there could be, like, a retaliation violence, like more events like Anders Breivik? Or do you see the violence as being pretty much one-sided on behalf of Muslims?
I think we're actually seeing some sort of retaliatory violence. Just before we came on, I saw a few tweets about a French refugee camp in Calais is actually ablaze. What it looks like, and there's also been reports of in Germany of citizens having to resist refugees who are being violent. So So while there are going to be people who obviously are going to try to avoid violence until it's too late, when it comes to most people, you push them too hard, eventually they are going to start fighting back. Whether they will actually succeed is one thing, but people are not going to just sit there and lie down as these invaders take their country away from them.
I mean, there have been a lot of arson attacks on empty refugee shelters in Sweden and Germany, I know. I mean, I could see, there could be a civil war, but what is interesting is that American conservatives like to talk about, like, Europeans as if they're a bunch of pussies, but I mean, I think Europeans are actually more likely to engage in, like, that kind of civil disobedience than Americans are. Americans very rarely engage in, like, direct activism. Americans mostly focus their activism online. And a lot of Americans or Americans will join the military, but that's about it.
Yeah. Basically, we have to remember that, well, it may seem like, you know, Europe is a peaceful place. We have to remember that it was Britain, France, Germany, Spain colonized most of the world, conquered most of the world. The same sorts of people who conquered most of the New World, the same sort of British who created the empire in which the sun never sets, they still exist. You know, they may have been lulled into complacency by wealth, by what happened in World War II, but they still exist. And if you push them too hard, eventually that warrior is going to come out. I do see Americans eventually going in that direction, but we are not as the problem is more present in Europe, obviously. So they're going to go overboard first. Eventually, if things get too bad in America, you know, like Trump may be our best chance to sort of avert the worst of it. But if things get too bad in America, eventually Americans will end up in the exact same boat.
And also in a lot of those countries, there's also massive unemployment. I mean, in a country like Greece, the unemployment rate is something like, I don't know the numbers, I think it's like 40%. So if the native population is unemployed, they're going to be even more pissed off. I mean, Germany and Sweden, I mean, still, those are very prosperous countries. But the people who are most pissed off about it are people who are unemployed and working class. I mean, even parts of Germany, like Dresden, have a lot of unemployment, like the former East Germany, so communist parts of Germany.
Yeah, and what's going to happen with these refugees coming in is that they're basically depressing the economic situation. I mean, probably talked to you in this prior to the podcast, I didn't come up with this idea, but it's like, you know, labor is a commodity like anything else. It has a price, and it's affected by the laws of supply and demand. You're adding in so many new people so quickly that it's going to be impossible for anyone to make a decent living. You know, I mean, other commenters have pointed out the absurdity of the U.S. continuing to take in large numbers of immigrants at a time where unemployment is at record highs. Economic pressures are one of the biggest drivers in changing the overall makeup of Europe or America or whatever.
Would you say that your general view towards the way things are headed, so you're basically a total pessimist?
Well, there's really no way to not be a pessimist at this point, because pretty much the vast broad strokes of what the alt-right has predicted is coming true, and from what it looks like, the violence part is coming true as well. You know, like, I don't take any joy. Only a psychopath enjoys hurting people or watching other people be hurt. But at this point, basically, that's what we've come to. There's no other way out of this. There were ways to avert this crisis, but they've all been ignored.
But also, if it were to happen, I mean, it would, in order to fix the problems in Europe, it would take pretty extreme measures. Traditionally, in the later part of the 20th century, Europeans have been very big on showing compassion towards other people. I mean, that wasn't always the case throughout history, but I think especially after World War II, I think that's pretty much been the case. But who knows, things could change in the future as the situation gets worse.
I'd say, you know, after two world wars that killed off a large portion of the continent's population, they were not looking forward to being belligerent. But at the same time, World War II, number one, the World Wars are a distant memory. You know, it's like the last few people who were alive then or saw them are dying off now. And we have a new threat in a hostile population that doesn't want to assimilate to European values, doesn't respect European culture, actually despises the native population, and adheres to a religion which says basically if you're not, if you either, convert to Islam or you die. It's as simple as that. There's simply no way to deal with this group of people at this moment that doesn't involve a solution that some people may find abhorrent, but that's it. You know, the world, to put it politely, the world is fucked.
How is America's situation different than Europe's situation? I mean, we're having a lot of the same problems. What are some of the factors that make America's situation different?
I think the central difference is that instead of having a large number of Muslims, we have large numbers of illegal aliens. And since they're not motivated by the same factors as Muslims, but the same threat of the country being swamped by a people who are alien to our values and alien to our way of life is still there. You know, we're not seeing it explode to outright violence right now because, again, you know, most Latinos are not they're Catholic, so they're not motivated by the same extreme desire to convert or kill the infidel as Muslims are in Europe. But at the same time, if the country doesn't advert from its path, you know, the U.S. is not going to exist anymore. You know, again, it's something of a cliche in the alternative right, but countries are not defined by geography; they're defined by their people. You know. Wherever, for example, in the case of France, you know, wherever there are French people, there is France. Wherever there are Americans, there is America. You know, Pat Buchanan said this back in the 90s. You know, it was like if you took like 10,000 like Zulus and dropped them into a town in Virginia, it would not be Virginia anymore. It would be, you know, like the Zulus, because a country is determined by the makeup of the people who live there. And if the U.S. continues to try to invite the world, eventually America will no longer be America. We're already starting to see that with the Democrats and Republicans trying to jockey to get the votes of the large numbers of illegal aliens here and immigrants in general to win elections.
I also noticed a change in the Overton window. I mean, you've talked a lot about, like, conservatives. I know traditionally, like, mainstream conservatives would say they're against illegal immigration because it's illegal and sort of the typical kind of conservative talking points. But I haven't actually noticed that lately Breitbart, like, their coverage of the situation in Europe, a lot of their articles are almost indistinguishable from something you would read on the alt-right. Like, they posted this video that's going viral about the whole invasion. And a lot of it's, like, not everything, of course, but a significant amount of stuff, like on this on immigration on Breitbart, is almost indistinguishable.
Yeah, eventually people are more intelligent are going to move over to the alt-right camp, and they already are. To a certain, they've been helped by other factors, such as Gamergate was a huge factor in like shifting the Overton window to the right by making it possible to crush and make fun of social justice warriors. The next trend is you have Donald Trump moving the Overton window to the right on immigration, whereas before he was running, it had been pretty much accepted by the chattering classes that America would give, the government would give amnesty to illegal aliens, to the point where they were going to run Jeb Bush, who said illegal immigration is an act of love, as their presidential candidate. Now we're not only talking about building a border wall, deporting illegal aliens, we're actually talking about punishing sanctuary cities like Chicago that actually coddle and give support to illegal aliens.
And did you write about, I know you also wrote about Ben Carson. I didn't get a chance to check out that podcast, but basically what was your sort of overall take on him?
He'd be better than the other candidates, excluding Trump, but I'm not going to vote for Ben Carson. The main thing that motivates support for Ben Carson is not his actual policies. It's because there's still a large portion of conservatives in America who are trying to appear to be not racist to the left. So they're supporting him not because of his policies, but because they're a black man, because they want the Democrats to pretty please stop calling them racist. We're not racist. We're voting for a black man. And I see Carson more or less falling away as the primaries get closer because he lacks, well, number one, he lacks Trump's ability to manage the media. And number two, really, his support is not based on who he is. And I don't think he's a bad person. He's a very accomplished, intelligent neurosurgeon. He's a smart guy in his career. I just don't think – but his supporters are largely motivated by identity politics and not by his actual policy platform.
Well, his policies, I mean, they're pretty much like a generic – he's pretty much like a generic Republican. I mean, Donald Trump is the only one who really stands out for taking different positions. I mean, even Ted Cruz, who was seen as this – as like the big Tea Party guy, I mean, a lot of – he has some pretty awful positions. I mean, Ted Cruz voted for measures to increase, like, H-1B visas by 500%. I mean, I'm not – he was seen as this political dissident, but Ted Cruz is pretty much on most issues with the establishment Republican Party.
Yeah, Cruz is still better than the establishment, but, you know, he's not someone who's reliable, and, you know, he's impacted by the fact that he has the atmosphere. He acts like a slimy used car salesman or a lesbian who does ASMR videos on the side.
I would like to thank Matt Forney for being on.
Thanks for having me on, Robert.
That's all we have for today's show. So take care, and we'll be back with you next time.